Well, hello and welcome to the Reconstructionist Podcast, where we are helping you reconstruct while you deconstruct so you don't self-destruct. So this week, I had the pleasure of getting on a phone call with Cody Matchett, who has been my mentor and friend for several years now, and his mentor and friend, Scott McKnight. Scott obviously has written a ton of books that have been very influential in Christianity, and he and Cody have actually written a book together on the book of Revelation. And so we dive into Revelation and all the different questions as much as you can do in a 40-minute time span, what the book is for, who it's about, what Babylon is, and the way that's infected our churches. And so it was a really fun conversation with the two of them, and I hope you guys enjoy listening to it as much as I enjoyed having it. So without further ado, here is Scott and Cody. Well, hello, Scott and Cody. How are you guys doing? You guys will have to go one at a time or you'll talk over top of one another. Cody, you've been on the podcast before. Scott, you're new, but many of our listeners will probably know who you are. So Cody, why don't you introduce yourself first? And then Scott, can you just give a little intro about how you're doing, who you are, and what you guys have been up to lately?
Yeah, my name's Cody. I am a PhD student in New Testament and a pastor in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. It's great to be back.
And I'm Scott McKnight. I'm a professor of 40 years.
Wow.
At Northern Seminary in the western suburbs outside of Chicago. And Cody was a student of ours and sometimes a teacher of ours. And when he was working with me as a graduate assistant, teaching assistant, I was working on teaching the book of Revelation, and he entered into that project with me and became a co-author. So it's our book together.
And so, well, I've known Cody for a long time, where when I was at Briarcrest College getting my bachelor's arts in Christian ministry, I don't know if he knew he was doing it, but he kind of became like a mentor figure to me. And so, well, I heard he was going to Northern because we went through that whole process. He's been trying to convince me to head there as well. But it was cool to see just like you guys interact and to see someone who I've got a ton of respect for, I don't know, be given the opportunity to like other people are like, hey, this guy's actually legit. And he started teaching on Revelation and stuff. And now you guys have actually written a book together on Revelation. And so I kind of wanted to dive. I find actually that it's so interesting to watch even behind the scenes, because up until this point, I've never watched someone kind of write a book or someone that I know. So to watch like the whole process that Cody has gone through on his side of it is so interesting, even to see how like long a book takes, where it comes from like an idea to it being like formed and edited. And it's like years. And then this book comes out, because I remember joking with Cody when it came out. I was like, so do you feel like over Revelation now? Where it's been like several years, you're like, oh, now I have to talk about it a lot. But what I found interesting is it feels like Revelation in a book like this is actually really timeless. And oddly enough, some of the stuff you guys talk about in your book, you might have thought, oh, that's like so 2 years ago. But then stuff has popped up recently that it's super relevant. And I found a book super helpful. But I wanted to ask you guys specifically, because out of all the books you could have picked to write and co-author together and work on, Revelation seems like one that a lot of people would be like, why? Because I think a lot of Christians either are really obsessed with Revelation in an unhealthy way, or like just want to avoid it like the plague. And so I was wondering for you guys, what made you guys want to dive into Revelation and write a book on it and like go through this process of wrestling through it and producing this thing?
Yeah, I'll begin, and then I'll let Scott really, really take the reins from here. It's really interesting at the beginning of his commentary on Revelation, Gordon Fee says something very similar to what you just said, which Gordon Fee says, you know, entering into the last book of the Bible, we're moving from, you know, sort of clear points of argument, if you will, although we could say Paul's not always that clear, into this bizarre language of dungeons and dragons and fire and beasts. And Fee says something very similar, which is that people either take an over-exaggerated interest in the book, or they take no interest in it at all. And Fee says, I want to argue that both of those approaches are wrong. And so I think because of that, in particular, that churches have either one of those two approaches, which is an over-obsession with this book, or they don't talk about it at all, And I think Scott and I would both agree that both of those approaches are wrong. Revelation is timely. I've often said to people, it's one of the most relevant books of the Bible for our particular moment in time, just not for the reasons that people think or that they've been taught to think that it's the most relevant book for our moment. And so I might respond with a why not. Revelation is wildly relevant to what's going on in our particular moment and the ways in which Scott and I, and I'll turn over to Scott now, but have tried to think about the nature of discipleship and political discipleship in a moment where we live in a very polarized world. And I think Scott and I also want to argue that whilst some might say that the speculator approach to Revelation is the right way to read it, I actually think it's caused the church far more harm than it has good. But I'll turn it over to Scott to answer the question.
Cody, I quoted that statement from Gordon Fee this morning in my own introduction to the Everyday Bible Study. This morning, I was looking at it, and I said, that is the way to introduce this book.
It is.
And it's so good, yeah. Yeah, we call one approach to the book of Revelation speculation. And way I often say it is these people are obsessed with who in the world today, Vladimir Putin, is doing what in the Bible, the beast from the land or something like that. And how does that fulfill predictions about, let's say, the tribulation and the rapture and the millennium and the end of time? And these sorts of people are constantly speculating about who fits the profile of what we see in the book of Revelation. I'm old enough to remember when Khrushchev was one of those characters. I'm not old enough to remember when Stalin was. But I remember when Khrushchev was, and then Gorbachev, because he had a birthmark on his head that could be the mark of the beast. I remember Henry when I was in college. People thought Henry Kissinger was could be one of the beasts. So they were always identifying this, and it did not take me long. Let's say I came of age about this stuff in about 1971. And by 1981, I thought these people were nutty and that they were always wrong. Everybody who predicted these things was always wrong. They had one generation from the birth of Israel to get these things right. And a generation in the first century is about 30 years, not 80. So I remember hearing that 1948, so at least probably 1978, but at the maximum 1988. Well, by 1988, you know, these issues were over. All those speculations of the 70s, which was a heyday for this stuff because of Hal Lindsey and Salem Kurban and Tim LaHaye in his first book about Revelation, John Walvoord, they everything that they predicted was wrong. And I thought they missed the opportunity. Now, the other thing that Cody and I write about is that in spending their time speculating, they miss the discipleship message that gives people an opportunity to develop what we call, well, I wanted to write about this, but the editor at Zondervan said the language doesn't fit, a theopolitical hermeneutic, and that is understanding God's perspective on, let's see, empire and tyrannical powers and corrupted leaders, and learning how to speak against that and to live as a faithful follower of Jesus when the political powers are against us. They miss all of that because they take the book and they move it all into the future and they speculate about who's doing what rather than what we should be doing.
And that's actually something I wanted to ask you guys, because I think for a lot of people, their confusion or struggle with Revelation is like, who is this book for? Because you'll have people who will say, oh, that was a book for like people a long time ago. It was just for the people who was written for then. It has no application to us today. You have people who kind of say, oh, that's for like a future people where these are all like predicting prophecies that are going to happen but haven't yet happened, or maybe some have. Or you have people who are like, this is for right now, any minute now, Jesus is going to come back and we're seeing this thing fulfilled before our very eyes. And so I wanted to ask you guys from your perspective, because people have those kinds of three different views of it. Who is this book written for? And like, what is the actual purpose of Revelation? Is it to like kind of have this like secret code that I'm supposed to crack as to like who the Antichrist is and what the mark of the beast is and try to sort that out very literally and specifically? Or is it for something a long time ago? Or is it something else? What, in your guys' opinion, is the book for, and who is it actually written to?
Yeah, thanks, Aiden. Let me sketch a few of those things really quickly. Some will talk about this book as entirely future, as you mentioned, the futurist approach. It's all for another time, which from that perspective, you have to imagine that God has to be pretty cruel to have John author this apocalyptic prophetic letter that he sends to seven churches in Western Asia Minor. And they would have understood none of it because it's all for a future day. That just seems wildly cruel. Some others have tried to do something more akin to a historical approach, which is that lots of this is for the future, but then each of the churches represent a particular moment in history. And anyone who knows church history would know that those letters don't fit periods of church history at all. It's a pretty outlandish approach, actually. And then some would say the technical term is preterist, but that this was all written specifically to the seven churches in Western Asia Minor, and it really doesn't have much relevance for us today. And I think for Scott and I, part of what we want to say is we believe that this is written to a context. Of course, it's written to seven churches in Western Asia Minor who are facing the pressures of Babylon to conform to the way of empire. They're struggling to be faithful in their discipleship to Jesus in the midst of the pressures of Rome. And so that it's written specifically to them. But we glean a lot as we interpret the letter in its context and try to figure out its relevance for us today. As Scott has often said, Revelation is a timely piece of literature to those seven churches, and it's timely for us as well. And so at the heart, we would say, people have forced me, this is kind of funny, Scott, you've probably had to do this a lot. People have asked me to sign their copies of the book, which I find profoundly uncomfortable. And I keep saying to them, this is going to ruin the resale value of the book for you. And so this is a waste of your time. But one of the things that I've highlighted in each of them is I've cited Revelation 14, right? That my hope for them is that as they read the book, they would learn to follow the Lamb wherever he goes. And so it's written to these churches who are learning to follow the Lamb wherever he goes. That's a big part of it. But I'll turn it over to Scott.
So people are asking you to sign copies of the book?
Yeah, it's a bizarre thing. Have you done that a lot? I'm sure you have.
I've signed thousands of copies of books. Not this one, but I signed a bunch of them last weekend. Cody, this is a part of a podcast, and it's informal. So only authors are supposed to write on this page. Always sign on this page, not this page.
Whoops. There you go.
Most authors don't even know this, but it's sort of the snooty upper class East Coast mentality of people who know which page an author should sign. They're only authors are supposed to write on that.
Only authors are supposed to write on that page. Before a public audience. So thank you.
I totally agree. I totally like what Cody had to say. I don't really have anything more to add to that.
That's totally fair. Other than he needs to figure out what page he's autographing books on. Otherwise, that resale value is going down. Everyone's like, who is this guy?
It's already gone down. Yeah.
No, it'll go up. It'll go up to have your name, have your author page on your
sign. I don't think so.
I have a few books I found by authors that were, I've bought used copies and signed by Joseph Epstein. So pretty cool.
Well, I said this on a different podcast recently, but when I was in Chapters once, I found a Bible that had a signed by author sticker on it, and that's been eternally funny to me.
Wow, that's incredible. And I think that's helpful, because I think that's why there's been a lot of confusion for people, and the struggle is that they just want to kind of place this in their different categories, but to recognize, hey, this is a book that's actually specifically written to a group of people, just like Paul's letters were. But then in the same way too, just like Paul's letters or any part of scripture, this book has so much more than just those specific things. It's timeless in the sense that it's speaking to all Christians of all generations. And when you try to put it in that box of, oh, it's just a specific prophecy and we're trying to like unlock this code of what does this mean and who specifically is the Antichrist and is it Justin Trudeau or is it Donald Trump or is it Vladimir Putin? And you're like, that's, you're way off base. And one thing that you guys say that I've seen a lot of people highlighting too is something really interesting is that often people kind of describe their view of Revelation based on the like reign of Christ and when you think that is, whether you're, and even like the tribulation and are you post-trib or pre-trib. And you guys in your book say that you find that really unhelpful. And actually the most helpful thing for you to do to understand Revelation is actually to begin to understand Babylon. Because if you can understand Babylon and what John is saying here, then it makes the rest of the book make way more sense. And you guys have kind of hinted at that already, that this book is about Christians living in a form of Babylon and what that actually looks like. And it makes the letters at the beginning actually make a lot of sense once you realize that. And so I was wondering if you guys could dive into that just a little bit of why is Babylon important for us to understand? And then what are the characteristics or some of the characteristics of Babylon that John is trying to get us to notice and to be aware of in every culture that Christians find themselves in?
Yeah, the way I like to say it is the book was written to the seven churches of Western Asia Minor in the first century, but through them to us.
Right. Mm.
And what John said to them in the first century can be explored as, let's say, template, guidelines, principles for us in our life today. And the problem for the seven churches is Rome, which John calls Babylon, because Babylon was one of the most heinous of countries in Jewish history, because it captured in 586 BC, it captured Jerusalem and transported most of the population, although I don't think we really know all that, all the way to Babylon. And then a flourishing Jewish community existed forever in Babylon, and it's just been diminished in the last 50 years. And the Babylonian Talmud, which is one of the greatest documents ever produced in Judaism, maybe the greatest, was produced in Babylon. So the Babylon becomes the trope in the Jewish world and the Christian world. Peter writes in 1 Peter 5:12 to those who are in Babylon, and he's talking about people in Rome. So Rome becomes Babylon to Jews and to Christians because it represents the powers that have invaded Jerusalem and taken them captive and oppressed them and kept the people of God from living in freedom. But then John just goes nuts in chapter 17, in Revelation 17, in describing the prostitute or the whore, whatever you want to call her, of Babylon. And this is a parody of Roma, the goddess in Rome. And it's, you know, they love this Roma. And John, as a Christian who probably was a Jew, depending on the authorship, this is endless debates. He sees this as idolatry. It's not God. And so he turns Roma into an awful, gross, hyperbolic description of a woman with sitting on seven hills and dressed in all the finery of the world and drinking out of a golden cup. And John's just sort of making fun of Rome at this point. And in the description, he gives the marks of Babylon that I think can become useful, we think, can be useful for us in analyzing our own country. And Cody can talk to you about the marks of Babylon.
Yeah, of course. I would say, too, this last round through teaching Revelation with my students, I had them come up with their own characteristics. And some of them were similar to ours, and others were slightly different. There are more than seven. Of course, there are more than seven. But it's Revelation, so Scott and I had to narrow it down to seven. you know, we could talk endlessly about these. Let me just say a couple. First, Babylon is anti-God, both for Jews and for Christians. That's clear. Rome and its rulers, I mean, they have their own thing going on, and it's certainly not what the Jews have going on. It's certainly not what the Christians have going on. There's opulence. Babylon or Rome is murderous. They're driven by image. They're militaristic. They're economically exploitative. When you get into that great list of items that the cargo that's being traded, you get a really beautiful list until the end when you see that it's also transporting the beings or the souls of humans. And so Rome is, they're exploitative. They're taking what they want from different places and they're shipping it to where they want it. And they're arrogant. Mm-hmm. They're marked by this arrogance, this mad arrogance. I mean, Scott mentioned getting drunk on from this gold cup. Well, the woman is getting drunk on the blood of the witnesses to Jesus. I mean, this kind of arrogance. She says in her heart, "I sit as queen, and I will never be widowed." I mean, this is every empire that's ever existed to say we rule and we'll never come down. We'll never be taken down. But if we could sum it up, if that's the seven that we sort of articulated in our book, as people read Revelation 17 and 18, they might find others, but we summarize it with the word domination.
Yeah. Because you're in Canada, I don't have to worry about this, but we had a president. We had a president who said, "Make America great again." That is Babylon, because he wanted world domination of America as the greatest nation in the world. That sort of arrogance is exactly what John is doing with the Babylon image. "I will never mourn," the queen says of Babylon. "I'm sitting here happy, satisfied, and no one will touch us." That's arrogance. That's Babylon. It's uncivil and inhumane. And all that, I think, could be wrapped up in Trump's desire in the United States. And it was embarrassing to many Americans and embarrassing to the world.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll say too, Aidan, coming back to your previous question, which is when we learn to think about Revelation a little bit backwards and we see that the general movement of this narrative is towards the elimination and the eradication of the evils of Babylon, the evils of domination, so that the New Jerusalem can come. Then, as you mentioned, when we get back to the churches, you can recognize that what's being rebuked in these churches is that there's too much Babylon in the church and not enough of the church in Babylon. Mm. And so John sees this conflict between the order of the Lamb and the order of the dragon. And Scott and I haven't had extensive conversations about this, but this is how I understand what John means by the tribulation, which is it's the friction between these two realities, these two alternate ways of ordering the world that are just clashing. You know, Scott was working on the Everyday Bible Series for Revelation today. In chapter 1, verse 9, John says, "I am your fellow participant in the tribulation, the kingdom, and the endurance that we have in Jesus." The tribulation is not future for John. He sees himself as a part of it. And this clash with Babylon, in some sense, becomes a key part of that tribulation, I think.
Yeah, and that's, you know, Gordon Fee calls it the collision of empires or something like this. Mm-hmm. It's really church in Babylon, church in Rome. This is a very big part of this book. And in that collision, John is trying to teach the believers of Western Asia Minor that they need to be able to see these things so that they'll know how to walk faithfully, how to be a witness, how to worship, etc. They need to discern the presence of Babylon. And last weekend, I called it Babylon creep, and some people really like that expression, so I'll probably be using that. Babylon creep is occurring for the seven churches in Revelation chapters 2 through 3. So that's what John wants people to do, to see what Rome is actually like, what they're doing.
Well, and I think that was one of the most intriguing things for me in reading your guys' book, was recognizing those signs of Babylon. And the thing that kind of freaked me out was recognizing that Christians in the West have really bought into Babylon without recognizing it, I don't think. Whether you think, because you used the mega example of like Donald Trump and being like, we need to make America great, and people can like poke holes at like conservatives and be like, see, you guys are like going in Babylon. But then even on the left too, you see the same characteristics of Christians who are like, oh, we need to be more like the left. And especially when it's been so interesting to watch, because Canada was different, I feel like, pre-COVID, where post-COVID, it feels so much more what I feel like America's like as someone who's never lived in America. But what I see on TV of like the more polarization of the two different camps and the high politicization of like Christianity, not that Christianity isn't political. I think a lot of what Jesus says affects politics and what you see the world as. I just don't think it's part of a party. It's part of like a kingdom value that you would have from Jesus. But it's been interesting in reading your book to recognize those characteristics and for me to look at it and be like, wow, I see a lot of Christians in a lot of places in the West who, and myself included, who are so encamped in these ways of Babylon. And so I'm wondering for you guys, you've kind of named some examples, but when you're looking at the Western church and thinking about Revelation and this whole idea, what are some of the ways that you see the church kind of buying into the Babylon system of running the world?
You know, I just read a book by a woman in the Pacific Northwest, Sarah Billups. It's called Orphaned Believers. And she talked, I think it was her, who said something like this, that one of the reason young Christians in the Pacific Northwest, which is very progressive, are walking away from the church is because a term like evangelical disconnects them from the people that they're talking to. So if you in that group say, I'm an evangelical, they won't want anything to do with you. Well, that's Babylon. That's where, you know, evangelicalism. Now, of course, in the United States, by the way, I see Canada as a part of America too. So I was corrected by a Canadian in 1973, and I've never forgotten it. Yeah. Wow. So, when we evangelical in the United States too often means a political party. It means a Republican. Mm-hmm. But there is something about the power of political alliances in the United States, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, just depends what group you're in. And if you feel ostracized as a Christian because your political orientation doesn't line up with someone else's, I think you're feeling Babylon at that point. Mm-hmm. That's what Babylon does, is that it makes you line up politically with the powers of a political party or the powers of a political leader or a political platform. And the witness, and I don't want to try to rescue the word evangelical here, the witness is we stand up for Jesus regardless of the political implication or the political parties that are surrounding us when we do that. That's what John means by the word witness. That's his term right there.
Yeah, I think in our own context, I mean, Aiden, offline, we were having this conversation about, you know, what are the metrics for success in ministry? What is a pastor? I know Scott is really appreciated, but I just finished teaching a class where my students read through Scott's Tove book and they loved it. Rave reviews, really great reports on the book. But beyond that, a book like Caitlin Beattie's book, you know, Celebrities for Jesus, where we think about and what has become of our metrics for success in the church when we turn to CEO and leadership culture and certain kinds of numbers and donations become the metrics for success. And then even the pastors who got into ministry to be pastors, and pastors pastor people. I mean, that's what pastors do. They are not pastoring people. They're caught up in the machine of a certain kind of production and allegiance to a political system. And they do it because they want to keep their job. And so they, even pastors who are conscientious of these things, they often end up feeling so stuck and trapped because they have families to support and people in their lives who are relying on them. And I think a lot of times people feel like, I don't want to leave this community because there are good people here. But I think that notion of when does the church start to look like Babylon? I mean, corrupted teaching is a big part of it, and misguided forms of worship. We talk about these things in our book, and I think Scott has already alluded to those, but we see the Babylonian creep, as Scott put it, that these things start to happen where our worship gets turned a little bit towards the political systems, and our teaching, we turn the text these ways and we ignore those texts because they don't fit within our paradigm. And I think a lot of our metrics as the church in the West have become skewed. And I think that we could point back to, at least abstractly, and say it's partially because of Babylon finding its way into the church.
You know, one of the themes of Babylon is opulence, and opulence is about wealth.
Yep.
And no one had more money than a Roman emperor, because all the taxes were paid to the emperor. He had all the money, and he dispersed it. He becomes the great a man of benevolence, but actually he was just giving people back money that he had taken from someone else. But we do not. Okay, I'm old enough to remember when Ronald Sider wrote his distinct book called Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger. Now, you guys are too young probably to know about this book. But the book was unbelievable when it was written. And there were people who called him a communist, a socialist, you know, they called him everything. And when I read it, I thought, by golly, this is really important. And there is something about economics that is so tied to Babylon that it has become invisible to the church and to Christians. And I'm not one who's going to spend my time saying capitalism is evil. I think every economic system has the capacity to be distorted by people who will use it to their own advantage. Capitalism included, socialism included. I mean, no, there are the countries that are sort of strictly socialist, not social democracy, probably have more people poor than any place in the world. I would say that Christians need an entire re-education, a re-discipling of our posture toward money, toward economy. And I think the book of Revelation calls us to see that sort of thing. Yeah, one of the churches, good. You know, you think you're rich, but you're not.
To dive into that just a little bit deeper, so for you guys in studying this book and going through this process, when you're looking at the church in the West, because that's all of our context, and you're seeing these different issues and the way Babylon has kind of creeped in to the church and into the lives and hearts of Christians, for many unknowingly, what do you think needs to happen in the church and in follower of Jesus's lives to have that kind of woken up to, and to be able for that to change, where the church is no longer like getting into bed with Babylon, but instead is following the way of the Lamb. What do you think needs to change? And obviously we can't solve all the church's problems in a podcast. We don't have enough time. But when you're looking at the church in the West, and for people who are listening to this, what are some like practical ways or what are some essential things that you think the church in the West needs to sort through or figure out or have themselves awakened to in order to kind of resist Babylon and head in the direction of the way of the Lamb?
Andrew Root is one of the pastoral theology professor analysts of American culture and American church culture, and why people aren't going to church, using the Canadian scholar Charles Taylor of the Secular Age. And Andrew Root would say this, and I think this is exactly the answer. Part of it is our imagination has been so reshaped by the secular age that we can't come up with a Christian imagination, a Christian social imaginary, as Charles Taylor talks about it.
Yeah.
And I think we have to have what Richard Hayes calls, in a different context, a conversion of our imagination, so that we begin to think outside the box of the secular age and begin to think of how Christians can live economically in a way that follows the Lamb and speak and embody a new message about capitalism, social democracy, socialism, communism, speak of these things in a way that is challenging on the basis of the vision of Jesus, the practice of the early church, the hints of this in the book of Deuteronomy, of course, and the actual laws, and in Revelation, where the woman is castigated for her opulence and luxury.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I mean, imagination plays a key role in all of this, of course. You know, we could go back to the first word of the book, which is where a lot of confusion comes from. I mean, apocalypsis, when we hear the word revelation or apocalypse, we think end of the world. But it, the imagination, then if it's a conversion of the imagination, I think John would probably also want us to think that there's an unveiling for many of us that needs to happen. And, and we don't see these things quite as clearly as we think we do. And there's a degree to which I think an apocalypse wants us to not place all of our confidence in our own eyes and our own ability to see and hear, because seeing and hearing, I mean, these are key themes in the book. And they, John really works with these themes quite rigorously to kind of mess with us. So I think we need a sort of pulling back of the curtain and ability to see differently. I often think of this is not related, in the word apocalypse doesn't appear here, but I often think of Moses, following the story of his birth. And then Moses, chapter 2, verse 11 in Exodus, Moses goes out and he's looking at the empire. And we get hints for the first time that Moses all of a sudden doesn't see the same empire that he maybe used to see or that other Egyptians see. Moses sees the problems that are at work. It's almost like he's had some kind of vision to see Egypt differently than he did before. And that leads, of course, to his snapping and his murdering of an Egyptian. But my point is, Moses goes out one day and he doesn't see the same empire that he sees before. He doesn't see the beauty of Egypt. He sees the oppression and the tyranny and the he sees all of these things that we're trying to describe. So I think it requires this kind of apocalypse that we can start to see differently and then disciple our way through that. Discipleship is key to the book of Revelation. It's key to what we're trying to talk about in our book. And I think we need a reinvigorated understanding of what discipleship looks like in our particular historic moment. And I'll just say one more thing. I've been saying lately, I read a quote from Chesterton from The Irresistible Man that has been sticking with me for a while now, which is Chesterton says something, I'm paraphrasing now, along the lines of things that create affection are fine so long he says things that are familiar are fine so long as familiarity breeds affection. But when familiarity begins to breed contempt, you better start defamiliarizing people with the stuff they think they know, because that's the only hope they have to love it again for the first time. And I think that this becomes key for a lot of people who are struggling, not just with the book of Revelation, but with Christianity and faith in general, is that they're coming back to the basics. They're defamiliarizing themselves. And that often is coming back to Jesus. And I think that's what this book is about again and again, is coming back to Jesus.
Chesterton. The problem with Chesterton is every sentence is quotable, and no one can quote it quite the way he said it because it's so clever. Yeah. Oh, man. All right. John also teaches his people that a part of their conversion of imagination and of all the things that Cody was just saying is to learn how to worship. There are 9 songs in Revelation, although there's debates about how many songs. I think David Awney has 16 songs.
Yeah.
Is that right? Doesn't he have 16?
I think it is. He has a lot.
Yeah. So he's a form critic, so he saw little snippets that he thought were hymns. But John, if you study the hymns of John, or the songs of John, the best analogy that I've heard for them is from the African-American scholar Brian Blount, who contended that they can be read through the practice of the spirituals in the African-American tradition, which were taking the language of the empire, the slave owner, his religion, Christianity, and taking those words that they heard in sermons from their slave masters and reworking them and reshaping them into songs that sounded ever so good to the slave master, but were actually songs of subversion.
Hmm.
And so John, I would put it this way, that the political morass that the Western church is in right now in the United States, and I'm not going to say anything about Canada because I don't know enough, and that is one of the biggest problems for the American church is that it has not embodied truly at the deepest level where it becomes permeating and pervasive, is they have not learned to worship the Lamb. They have not learned to worship God enough that gives them eyes to see Washington, D.C. or Chicago or Berlin or London or Montreal, Toronto, whatever, Vancouver, and see in those powers things that are out of line with the worship of God.
Mm.
And it is, I think that our lack of worship, and I don't mean singing songs with our hands raised on Sunday morning, but a fullness of worship, is one of the biggest reasons why the American church is so corrupted politically today, because it no longer knows the difference between allegiance to a political party or to Washington, D.C., and allegiance to Jesus. That's a good sermon right there.
It is. I want to be gracious to your guys' time because you guys have been super gracious to me. And so just one last quick question for each of you. I just kind of want you to tackle the two different people I imagine listening to this, where for you, Scott, if you could kind of imagine just talking to the person who is hearing this and hearing about Revelation and your guys' book and is like, this sounds great, but I've seen this book so abused and manipulated that I still have zero desire to read it. I just want to avoid it. Could you maybe tackle what you would say to that person who's like, I just want to avoid this book. I have zero interest in it. And then for you, Cody, for the other person who is listening to this being like, Scott and Cody are out to lunch. They're nuts. They're wrong. They're not reading it right. And I know the proper way to read it. Could you tackle for that person when they just hear what you're saying and are very resistant to how you guys are reading this book? And so just the two different people I mentioned. So yeah, Scott, for you.
I would say give it a chance and read it. This is the way I would put it. Read it as fiction, the way you mm-hmm. read Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, Chronicles of Narnia. I don't know who else. Who else do I mention? I would say Virgil's the Aeneid, Homer's Iliad and the Odyssey, and also even John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. The way you would read, instead of getting trapped into the speculation stuff, read it as fiction and come away with the story that is taking place from the vision of Jesus in chapter 1 to the vision of Jesus at the end of the book, and all those judgments or disciplines in the middle that seem to reconfigure the world so that it would be fit for New Jerusalem, and just forget who is doing what and just see what the story does for you. And I think you will discover that any desire for a progressivism in our world matches the vision of the book of Revelation.
Yeah, I wonder in some sense if the advice sort of won't be the same here. Get lost, just don't get left behind, right? That's what we say in the book. I might say that, for those who think we're out to lunch, you're resistant to these categories or the ways that we're chatting about it. I understand that. And I just want to say first that I'm sympathetic to that, because I think so many of us are taught through particular lenses and categorizations and frameworks. And so similarly, I might say, I've used this language for years. I used it in a Substack post when we were promoting the book. I just want to encourage the hospitality of hearing. Just try to set aside what's going on with the millennium or who the Antichrist is, and just try to really hear it as for the first time. Hear it. That's the way it's meant to be performed. And so, you know, John says at the beginning, flourishing is the one reading, just one reading, those hearing, and ultimately those observing. And so I might say, if you could, forget about everything we've said and just go back to Revelation itself and read it again as for the first time. And similarly to what Scott's saying, just try to read it for what it says and I'll let it evoke things. Revelation often evokes, but it doesn't explain. And it's more of a visceral experience where you're supposed to really feel it. And so I would say, I understand, I'm sympathetic. I have people in my own life who are really resistant to a book that I wrote. And so I understand, and I'll just say, I just want to invite you to go back to Revelation and try to read it without your frameworks and categories and assumptions.
Super helpful. Guys, thank you so much for hopping on here. I really appreciate it. For those who haven't read the book yet, I encourage you to pick it up. It's super helpful in giving you framework for reading and understanding this book. And so, yeah, guys, thank you so much for doing this. This has been awesome.
Thank you.